With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1107. I'd like to call the senator. I'd like to come on over. Hold on 1 second. And Carol, why don't you give us what the 1107 does?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Carol, be happy to. Senate Bill 1107 is a bill that authorizes any seller of alcohol beverages to accept any identification card that has been issued by any state or federal governmental agency that bears a picture of the person and contains sufficient information for that person to be identified.
Okay, Senator Duke, glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Chair, committee members, I'm Joan Duke, State Senator for District 1, and I'm the sponsor of this bill, but the gentleman sitting next to me is the story and what's been going on in his story is why I brought it, so I'm actually going to let him talk, and I'm going to sit here and be quiet.
Okay. Welcome. As you know, that you free to state your name and you may proceed.
Name and...
Thank you.
My name is Skip Hockey. I'm from Astoria, Oregon, and I'm the owner of Hockey Century Market. And I'm proud to say it's a third-generation grocery, 109 years old.
Okay. I was going to say, you work hard. I used to
and I don't even look at
the owner myself.
Yeah. You don't look a day over 108, sir.
And I appreciate that. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to meet with you and offering me a chance to share some of my thoughts from a retailer's point of view in regard to OLCC's rules on acceptable identification for alcohol purchases. As grocery retailers in the state who are licensed to sell alcohol by the state of Oregon, we are charged with the responsibility to check the identification of anyone who appears to be under 26 years of age. By law, only three pieces of identification are acceptable. They are as follows: a current driver's license with photo, a valid Oregon DMV ID card, and a valid passport. If an Oregon customer does not have any of the above, it is illegal to serve, sell, or even give alcohol to that customer. It is my opinion, backed by 30 years of retail experience, that these requirements are both justified and respected. Where I do disagree with our regulations is how we are asked to treat our potential customers from Washington, Idaho, California, or any other state in the nation. Why do we find it necessary to treat them different than our own citizens? The only two pieces of identification we may accept from our neighbors to the north, south, or east are either a current driver's license with photo or a valid passport. In reality, if we consider how many people would carry their passports with them on a trip from Vancouver to Portland, we really only accept the valid driver's license as identification. But what if that passenger, or if that Washington citizen doesn't drive or is simply a passenger traveling with others or by bus or train? Why would we want to treat he or she like a second-class citizen? Why shouldn't we be allowed to accept a Washington DMV ID card? It has definitely been our experience at Hockey Century that those customers who do not have a valid driver's license do carry an ID card. And it is very embarrassing to those of us on the front lines to tell those customers that the state of Oregon does not consider these cards as valid identification. If we look at this DMV ID card issue from a practical matter, we may even conclude that it is less restrictive for a visitor from a foreign country to buy alcohol in my Astoria market than it is for someone who lives just 4 miles across the river. The foreign visitor would certainly be carrying a passport, and that is all the identification we would require. We wouldn't even care if our foreign friend had a driver's license. My final point would be that by following our present rules, we may be saying one thing and practicing another. When I shared with you the three pieces of identification acceptable in Oregon, I really missed one additional piece, and that is a statement of age card allowed by our state. The statement of age card may be used if a customer has neither a driver's license, DMV ID card, or valid passport. This statement, and I've attached a sample with your documents, would be filled out by the customer, completed by my employee, signed by both parties, and backed up by two pieces of official ID. One of which can be the DMV ID card from any state. I'm sorry, I should have passed that earlier. I apologize.
We were scrambling around.
I'm sorry.
This
is new to me. So, along with a statement of age card, we are allowed to take an ID card from another state. And it is called an official piece of ID. So to me, what this is saying is that the state of Oregon does accept a DMV ID card from other states as an official identification document in one case and says no in another. Once again, I'd like to thank the committee for allowing me the opportunity to offer my opinion. And on behalf of thousands of retailers just like myself, I ask for your support. Please allow us to accept DMV ID cards from other states. Visitors are an important part of the economy of Oregon, and we respectfully request the tools to treat them as we would our next-door neighbors. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hockey. Okay. Thank you. The driving all the way down from Korea area. We love that place. I go over there. Fishing and beautiful place.
Mr. Chin.
Senator Fisher.
It looks like we could get into business with requiring Washington people to get passports to come down here to buy their...
Mr. Chair, it's beneficial. We weren't trying to go there. If you'll look on line 17 of the bill, sub D, what we are looking to allow is any other states, and there's a dash one amendment that you should have that I worked with Ms. Hutchinson on, we would like to allow just outright authorization for someone selling alcohol to accept, besides an Oregon ID card and a driver's license from any other state, that they could also accept another identification card issued by another state, this dash one changes the next part to any U.S. military identification card that has what you see, the name, a person's address, their date of birth, a physical description, and a signature of the person. So all three of those pieces of identification, or four actually, your passport, your driver's license, your identification card, or a military ID, have the same information on them. They have a picture, they have a date of birth, they have a physical description, they have a signature.
Okay.
And those are the things that we're looking at. We're simply saying that there is more than one thing. It's not unusual to have someone come from Washington State, the Chinook area, over to Astoria, and they've come to avoid the sales tax in some cases. They've come because they can do a lot of shopping there because it's a more central area. There's a Costco, there's a Fred Meyer's, there's a Hauke's, there's other kinds of things, stores there, and then one of the things they want to buy is alcohol. And they have an identification card from Washington. For whatever reason, they don't have a driver's license. And if they have a passport, as Mr. Hockey said, they're not carrying it with them. So I think it was an oversight when the law was passed that we made reference to an ORS on the identification card. The ORS only applies to Oregon's ID. And once we checked in the military ID, that we have a lot of military in that area, and I know I was talking to an officer today who said it's more important to me to carry my military ID with me than it is to carry any other form of identification. And yet, he has to turn them away today if that's all they have on them.
Okay. Any questions from members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
I guess I don't understand the statement of age situation here. you indicated that the identification was accepted on the statement of age. Is it only that it's only half of the requirement? They have to have some other piece, and so if they came with just a statement of age and didn't have something else, they would still be limited.
They need two additional pieces of identification, official identification. The first one, I believe, and I don't remember all of them, but one is an ID card. One can be a...
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, it could be a letter that has been mailed to the person showing his name and his address, or a bill that is sent to him, like from a utility bill or something like that.
So nothing that requires an age statement or any kind of a assumption of age. It would just be establishing his identity.
And the other piece, Senator Fisher, could be, you know, a birth certificate, but those things don't have a picture on it. I think that the idea behind it is that when someone is actually asked to sign something like this, if they have falsified the document, it's a Class C misdemeanor. And it's a little more serious.
I was under the impression that there was quite similar bill coming from the House. It's already here in the Senate, I believe going through the Senator Duncan's committee, that relates to the something about the blind identification or...
Senator Lynn, Senator Fisher, I don't believe that's the case. There is someone here, I have not introduced myself, excuse me, Barb Hutchison from the Liquor Commission. There is someone here today, Mike Bullock.
Yes, who touched my
arm. And he brought this issue to our attention at the beginning of the session, and this will help alleviate his concerns as it relates to blind, disabled people.
Okay. Well, it sounds to me, Mr. Chair, like this maybe is a little more all-inclusive than perhaps the House bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I don't believe there is a House bill, at least none that I am aware of.
Mr. Chair, there's definitely a House bill because it was requested to come to my committee, and I applied to have it sent to my committee, and it had already been sent to Senator Duncan's committee, and I checked into it a little bit. The reason that they were directing to my committee is because my daughter is blind. They knew that I understood the issues, but I believe that only referred strictly to the situations with the blind and not anything to do with the U.S. military identification or anything like that. So I wish that maybe while we're here we could have somebody check that out real quick for us and let us know, because there's no duplicating issue.
Senator Duncan will be coming in shortly. By the time we will find him, but
it just got assigned, so I don't know for sure if he's had a chance.
Okay, at least let's go ahead this one. Yeah. Let's see what happens, okay? And any questions from the members? And Barbara, you'd like to testify on your part on this bill?
Mr. Chair, the commission is neutral on this bill. I have had an opportunity to work with Senator Dukes on it. One of our concerns, of course, always is that it gives minors yet another avenue to forge identification, but they seem to be able to do that very well with existing Oregon identification. So I'm not sure that this is going to create a much larger problem, but it is something that the commission is very concerned about, and we will be watching it.
Okay, so you are not either support or either
Senator Lynn, that's correct.
About the small case of amendment to dash one. Have you read that also?
Mr. Chair, yes. Senator Dukes and I worked that out together.
Okay. As you agree, the whole thing is in order. So.
Mr. Chair, it seems to be in order.
That's what I need. Okay. Anything you'd like to add?
No.
If not, well, thank you, Senator. And thank you. Okay, next person I'd like to call Mike the Bully. Mike.
Yes.
We're glad to have you with us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Bullis. I'm here representing the National Federation of the Blind and also own and operate the Kaleidoscope Tavern here in Salem, so... have some experience with this issue from two aspects. First of all, maybe regarding Senator Fisher's question, I have not been involved with any bill on the House side, although early in session I did see one over there that would have impacted this issue a little bit. However, I haven't had any involvement with it because this bill hit the mark directly, and the other bill had some other issues it was dealing with, so we went with this one. Now, there may be another House bill, and it may be one that we'll want to take a look at. I, too, have had a chance to look at the Dash 1 amendments. They look fine. Our concerns were that blind people, in a couple of instances, who came from other states, who, of course, didn't have driver's licenses and were trying to purchase alcohol, had trouble. So we looked at the issue and came here for the resolution that obviously non-driver's ID from other states should be allowed. In some ways, this bill actually legitimizes current practice of fairly experienced bartenders probably would look at this a little bit, would look at some non-driver's ID from another state, and if they had any concerns about it, wouldn't serve the person, but in a lot of cases they may. My experience is that if we have any concerns about people, we aren't going to serve them, and even the statement of age card, frankly, if my bartenders have to go to the trouble of dealing with a statement of age card, they probably won't serve the person anyway, because it's a lot of trouble. Everybody has to fill out and sign all kinds of things, and in a practical day-to-day business, those statement of age things aren't really usable. I guess the only final thing I would say, Mr. Chair, unless there are any questions, and I say this tongue-in-cheek, is that, this really does affect non-drivers, and if we wanted to eliminate the problems associated with alcohol, perhaps we should just write the bill so that only non-driver's ID is acceptable. Then we'd eliminate most of the problems that we have with alcohol-related fatalities, et cetera. Is there any questions that we've got to answer?
Okay, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goldberg.
Thank you very much. Not a question, but a comment based on the written testimony that we have from Mr. Bullis, where you state that passage of Senate Bill 1107 would allow businesses to be fully compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Is there more that you would like to say about that particular statement?
I think that this really is sort of an issue that was brought to my attention as a discriminatory issue in that the blind people involved and other people who have disabilities. There's a significant reason why someone who has a disability, whether it's blindness or any other disability, would not drive if it impairs their ability to function to a large extent. There's a good likelihood that they would not drive, and therefore the way we set up our identifications and what's acceptable, we are sort of pointing at a group of people with disabilities, and it does raise some questions about ADA compliance that this bill would take care of.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Fisher.
I don't use the products under discussion here and don't wish to really encourage their usage, but there's a matter of fairness here with things that are legally accepted by the state, and I appreciate Mike coming here. Not only does he have knowledge of the operation of these businesses, but he also has knowledge of the problems that you face when you don't have a driver's license, and so I think that he's given us a real good picture of this, and I'm personally very supportive of a situation here that does treat a bunch of our citizens in an unfair manner.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Duncan, you have a question for the
amount? No, it's just... Just with the bill, I guess. Maybe it's a question. I was talking about yesterday. It's a concern that I have. And I'm sorry I had to be out. I'm trying to meet a 3:30 deadline on getting notifications, so that's why I was hustling. But anyhow, I'm just wondering how easy it would be to forge some sort of identity document, and that was my concern. I raised that question with you yesterday when you and I were chatting. I pulled out my retired military ID, that's my picture and so forth, but I was just trying to think, if you go into a store and you have a clerk. And nowadays with computers and everything, it seems to me like a very creative young person could create a very official-looking ID card and, you know, make it up for something that would be very difficult for a person to check out and get in there. And that was my, that was the concern I raised yesterday. And I don't know if you've had a chance to think about that, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, we have the Dash 1 Amendment, which limits the military type of ID that you can use to U.S. military identification, the kind that you pulled out of your wallet yesterday. I thought some of our conversation yesterday centered around the language was broad enough that you could take any federal identification. And there may be some that were not, that there were so few of them that would be easy for someone to go out and duplicate it. The reality is that Oregon's driver's license appears to be so easily duplicated that I think there's, as Barb Hutchinson from the OFCC was saying, there is some concern that, yes, you could get a state identification card that was fraudulent from another state, but they're going to be so insignificant in numbers that the true threat is from our own easily duplicated driver's license. And that's where they're having the biggest problem. Personally, and this is only me speaking, I think we were sold a bill of goods when we were sold, when the company came in and convinced us that we had to go to this new driver's license. Everything I hear and from all of the campuses across the state, it seems to be far easier to duplicate than anything we've had recently.
Mr. Chair,
one of the things I would say that as a practical matter, taverns and restaurants and stores can purchase a book. I can't remember how much it is, but basically in the book there's a picture of every state's ID. One of the things we teach our employees is how to use that book so that if somebody comes here from Kansas, you can flip to a page that shows you the Kansas driver's license and the Kansas ID card. So then you're going to know basically what they look like. And then we also try and teach our employees how to identify whether that card has been mutilated or forged in any way as best they can. So there's a lot of training. We work pretty hard at it because we live in a part of town. Our business is in a part of town where people are always trying to slip something past us. So it's an art to trick to identify false ID, and it's also an art to make it, I guess. So.
But one of the purposes of the Dash 1 Amendment was to narrow down that military, I mean that federal ID, so that it's just the military ID.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
They still have in here any state ID, as I read it. Any other identification card issued by a state. So why would it be now states issue identification tags? You see the department people wearing them around their neck, that open doors for them.
That's not an official state identification, at least not where we're headed here.
It doesn't say official. It just says any other identification card issued by a state.
Right. And every state has an official identification card. Ours is issued by the Department of Motor Vehicles, and it looks a whole lot like the driver's license, but you don't have to take a driving test to get it. And it's the card that anyone who's not driving can get to get an official identification card, and every state issues one.
Yeah, but it says any other identification card. It doesn't say that state the identification card that takes the place of the driver's license. Perhaps it's the official state identification card issued to those that for some reason can't get a driver's license or something to that effect, because this to my way of reading it, just say they issued any kind of identification card to anybody, it shouldn't.
This will all be subject to rules issued by the OLCC.
But they changed that to the military, and that's U.S. Okay.
Okay, so these other identification cards would not have the date of birth?
Or the physical description. They may have a picture on it, and they usually don't have a signature, they may. But the ones that we're looking at, the official state identification card, like your driver's license, all have a picture, physical description, date of birth, signature.
And there are several of those items then that are required here.
That would not be
on any of the, and again, I've never looked at the department cards in any. No, I've seen the identity. Yeah, I've seen the identity card that the state sets out, and daughter has one. But never looked at the ones that the employees of the agencies wear around their necks. I believe those work on the door openers and different security arrangements that they have in the different departments. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, because they have a picture on it, they don't include an identification and a description.
All right. Any more questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Is there any other person like to testify on Senate 1107? Hearing none, we will close our public hearing on Senate 1107. And are we ready to have a work session? This one, okay. We'll look at work session 1107. We need to adopt the Dash 1 amendment, I guess.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1107.
Okay, so Gordillian moves the Dash 1 to the floor with the Senate Bill 1107. Any objection? Any discussion? If adopted, yes.
I did want to ask Senator Duncan about that other bill, though, because it was in his committee, and now he's taking a powder. So.
Okay. ready?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if you're ready for the motion.
I think so.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1107 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordillian moves that the Senate 1107 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Okay. Let's call the roll.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Did we do the Dash 1 amendment?
We did.
Okay.
Yes. Aye.
Senator Duncan? Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
Chairman?
Aye. And the Senator, are you voting for 1107 as amended? It's a good deal.
I moved the Dash 1 amendment.
Yes, you did.
And then the door for the first.
I vote aye. Okay. And Senate 1107 and passed. And Senator Fisher, would you? Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. okay. Thank you. Then the Senator Duke will carry the Senate 1107 since you are one of the major sponsors. Thank you very much. Okay, I'd like to close our work session with Senate 1107. Where's Senator Duncan? With that, what's the next one?
Rush, I was asked by Representative Devlin to run that through my committee, and I made that request, and his letter arrived the same day it was assigned to your committee, and I wasn't able to get it in time.
I'll
to your committee instead, and I figured you'd be looking at it pretty reasonable, but it sticks in my mind that it refers to quite a similar, at least some portion of it, similar to what we just did with 11.
I'm glad you alerted me. I'll ask Marjorie in the second.
Okay. With that, I'd like to open up for the hearing, Senate Bill 1132. Chris Lyon, and also. Okay. Chris and Dave. I'd like to welcome you again. It seems to me we are meeting you regularly.
On a weekly basis.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Chris Lyons. I'm the director of the Oregon Lottery, and with me today is David Cooper, our public affairs manager. As the members of the committee may recall, a few years ago, the state of Oregon conducted an extensive task force process to examine the entire scope of issues related to gambling. As Senator Kirkland knows, who sat on that task force. This task force included leadership from both houses of the Legislative Assembly, appointees by the governor, representatives from the lottery and the tribes, as well as many others with an abiding interest in the issue. In-depth research was conducted and over 30 public hearings were held. This process focused on key subjects such as the regulation of gambling, gambling marketplace and competition within that marketplace, and most relevant to the bill before you today, the social impact of gambling. The task force report and the findings of each of its subcommittee have been provided to the committee staff for your reference. One of the key recommendations of the task force was to create an independent gambling council to conduct objective scientific research into the variety of issues associated with gambling. This vital role has been admirably filled by the Oregon Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation. This nonprofit organization was formed within months of the task force recommendation, and its primary mission is to conduct research. The foundation has already completed a statewide prevalence study of gambling and problem gambling in 1997, a statewide study of youth gambling, which was conducted in 98. And in 1999, the foundation will conduct a similar study on gambling by the state's senior citizens. Completing this fundamental baseline research is necessary before any meaningful understanding of gambling's social costs can be derived. I recall from previous testimony by Mr. McCracken, the executive director of the Treatment Foundation, who will also be testifying today, that once this preliminary work is done, the foundation intends to examine gambling's social costs into the future. I also recall from this testimony that there was no consensus in the scientific community on what constitute valid and legitimate criteria and methodologies for determining the highly controversial subject of social costs. It is my understanding that the foundation has already contacted Dr. Rachel Goldberg, one of the nation's preeminent authorities on gambling research. She, in turn, is working on this issue at the national and international level to develop criteria and methodologies for social cost research that will withstand the challenges to its validity. Frankly, until such research has been developed and accepted by the scientific community, another task force on this subject is probably premature. Once these standards are in place, the foundation's ongoing baseline research will provide valuable statistical information for use in future social cost research and subsequent examinations by policymakers like yourselves. Mr. Chairman, I believe the intent of Senate Bill 1132 is already being undertaken through the foundation's ongoing research. I also support the recommendation of the last task force that an independent body, such as the foundation, is the most appropriate organization to conduct this social cost research. I thank you for the opportunity to testify and would be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, not a question, just a comment. I really appreciate your testimony in that Ms. Lyons has anticipated or addressed the question that I had, which basically is how would the work of this task force, the one called for in Senate Bill 1132, be different from the previous governor's task force, which did issue its final report in 1996. Ms. Lyons has provided clarity for me on what that past work was and the direction of the current, is it the foundation?
Yes.
And so I'm left wondering at this juncture, unless I hear something more compelling, why we need this particular bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gortley, I appreciate your comments, and I think just to take the opportunity to reiterate the point that the examination of social costs is so difficult, and what the governor's task force did was basically said there really wasn't enough data and the methodologies were not there to do that very extensive piece of work and for that work to have credibility. And what we needed was time, and the Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation has sort of been assigned with the task of beginning to gather that research information, create those baselines, then move into the examination of the social costs, and then we'll be able to come back at a later time, and the policymakers will have sufficient data that's really credible on which to make additional policy recommendations beyond what the governor's task force was able to do with the limited information it had. And the task force did a good job, but really more information is needed so that another step can be taken.
More information and from an independent body, yes. That's what I hear.
Yeah, that was a key, really a key message of the task force, because this is, in fact, so controversial. That really an independent look by professionals where not only policymakers but members of the gambling industry would be able to look at this data with some assurance that it was in fact correct and not prejudiced based on somebody's values. So.
Sure. Well, I would think that having been on that panel, I would echo what Ms. Lyons is saying, that the you know, we had the typical suspects, Ecumenical Ministries, we had, you know, very good people in the room on the issue of the social impacts and really did struggle with the fact that this is such a new area that it was very difficult to get any hard data on that would make a case, because the minute you throw the word social in there, you create this very subjective sort of realm that crosses a lot of paths in terms of trying to determine the real consequences. So you had law enforcement on the one hand, you had the psychologists and sociologists and the ecumenical ministry types on the other, all with valid points of view, but nobody had anything to really back them up, and it just was beyond the purview of the subcommittee that took that on, and it was beyond the purview of the task force as a whole to be able to say with any finality that, yes, verily, there's these consequences, and we should take these actions. So I think that task force was a great first step, but that particular area, probably more than anything, was most problematic in terms of not having data.
Mr. Chairman, the other commitment that was made at that time was that Jordan Lottery and others would provide the funding to begin creating the research and to gather the information, and we have been moving forward and making those financial commitments so that we can gather the information that's necessary for the next step. Mm-hmm.
Any questions? David, you have anything to share?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. I believe Ms. Lyons' testimony has really covered it. I know that
excuse me, for the record, my name is David Hooper, Public Affairs Manager with the Oregon Lottery. I know Mr. McCracken of the Foundation will testify. I think really the key message that I would reiterate is that you really have to build the research to get the data, and we've done that with the prevalence study statewide. We've done it with the youth study. We will take the next step with the senior study. That's the sort of data that will really help when the issue of examining social cause, trying to fix the numbers of that, that's all the information you need in the first place. And I know Mr. McCracken will talk about the work being done on the national and international level, and his contacts with Dr. Goldberg, and the work she intends to do for the foundation in the future on social cost studies.
Okay. I believe that the gambling is the world's third oldest occupation.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't hear you. You were talking that way, I didn't hear you.
Oh, okay.
It was not for your ears anyway. It was quite risque, what he just said.
Probably for the older crowd.
Yes. I said, gambling is the third oldest occupation in the world.
Oh, okay.
And the first two would be, Mr. Chair?
And that's the reason why I'm saying it. With that old history, you should have some basis of it. Some place in somewhere. And the only we need to gather the information. And to us, it's amazing. I'm hearing that the even gambling going on many years in our country, and we are saying we don't have any data in our state, in our country.
And Mr. Chairman, this was quite a revelation, I think, for the task force. And you know, we held 30 hearings, and we spent a lot of time and money attempting to gather information, and I think we were all surprised at how much anecdotal information was out there, but in terms of really hard, fast facts that had been gathered through some kind of scientific process based on some standards, the study of the issue of gambling is really so new, not only in terms of understanding the pathologies associated with it, but the treatment, that the data really, frankly, was not there. And Mr. McCracken will inform you that Oregon, in terms of its treatment and the research, is really light years ahead of many jurisdictions. And the information, other than anecdotal, there really isn't that factual foundation yet. It really was one of the key recommendations from the task force is it said, begin to create some baselines in Oregon so that we can gather this information, and we will, a few years down the road, be able to make some decisions that are really founded in fact. So we were surprised, too, that something that's been around for so many, many hundreds and hundreds of years, that there was so little data.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
I
think we ought to bring someone from out of state and have them stay and spend some time studying this issue.
Maybe like a lieutenant governor from another state?
Bring them to Oregon to stay.
I'm still a scientist.
If you're going to stay, gamble.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Okay. If no other question, then I'd appreciate the testimony given to us. And
I still have a question for the chair.
Oh, me?
Yes. I understand. You said that gambling is one of the three oldest professions, and I'm going to take a shot in the dark and assume that one of those other professions might have been prostitution. What's the third one? Is it politics, or is it something else?
Politicians.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
I didn't say, you said.
Well, if that's not it, what is it?
Mike McCracken and Ellen Law.
I don't think it's agriculture. Senator Fisher thinks it's agriculture, but I don't think he's right.
Hunting.
We've had some very bad guesses in this group.
Well, it's getting late in the afternoon, Mr. Chair, I can tell. It's disintegrating.
Good afternoon, Mike, members of
welcome
the committee.
And Ellen.
Mr. Chair, I consider it a privilege to continue to meet with this committee and
and I want you and the committee members to know how valuable it is to have this forum to continue to discuss gambling addiction-related issues. It's a very good way of communicating through you to the entire legislature, and we consider your input to be very valuable in all of our planning. And so I want to thank you for this opportunity. With me today is Helen Lowe. She's one of the charter members of the Oregon Gambling Addiction Foundation, which was referred to just a few moments ago, and Helen will have a few remarks to make. I've submitted written testimony. I'll try to go through fairly quickly. We are here today to suggest, and we mean that just as a respectful suggestion, we certainly would not presume to try to influence how the legislature wishes to conduct its own business, and certainly that kind of interim study just set up our legislative business. But we do have the suggestion to make that our activities will really provide the kind of information that you're looking for in the proposed task force. And I do want to point out that our studies are not funded by any tax dollars. The foundation was formed in January 1997 pursuant to the governor's task force on gaming. Our foundation was started up with funding provided by Spirit Mountain Casino, an arm of the San Juan tribe, funded with dollars from the Oregon Lottery and from the Oregon Restaurant Association and from gambling addiction treatment providers in our own association, a private nonprofit association of community mental health directors that also contributed dollars to its start. Our purpose is to conduct researches into the causes and effects of problem gambling, to inform Oregonians about problem gambling, to let them know that there's community-based effective treatment programs out there, and to research the effectiveness of gambling addiction treatment methods. The foundation is a private, nonprofit, public benefit corporation and does not take positions on whether or not gambling should be legalized or expanded or on other political issues, except the one issue, and that is that we do promote gambling addiction treatment services. In March of this year, a study called the Gambling Impact and Behavior Study was submitted to the National Gambling Impact Study Commission that was set up a few years ago by Congress and funded finally after some delay by the President. It's been meeting now pretty intensely for about 18 months. So they're just now beginning to receive some of the reports that they've contracted for. I reviewed this specific report, the Impact and Behavior Study, in detail, and found that the report dealt mainly with surveys of adult gambling behavior and asked questions about the frequency of gambling and determined the prevalence of problem and pathological gambling around the nation. The study also included a section on an economic analysis of the consequences of gambling problems, and that's the one issue, I think it's probably the biggest issue in that task force bill. I contacted Dr. Rachel Volberg, who was one of the authors of that part of the study, and asked her about the acceptability of the methodologies that she and her colleagues were using in determining the economic and social impacts of gambling. And she replied, and it's a quote, "There is a long ways to go before there is a widely accepted methodology for conducting social impact studies of gambling." I review that research to point out that the Oregon Foundation has already made a substantial beginning in conducting research studies as first steps in getting to ultimately determining what are the social effects of gambling and problem gambling on the citizens of this state. To reiterate earlier testimony we did in August of 97, published the Gambling and Problem Gambling in Oregon, that was conducted by Dr. Volberg, and that study provides baseline data about the extent of adult gambling in Oregon and about the prevalence of problem and pathological gambling. And as you may recall, because we presented that report to all legislators and before this committee, that about 3.3% of adult Oregonians are either problem or pathological gamblers. This study also allowed us then to make much more accurate projections in our budget for gambling addiction treatment. We reviewed that with you as we were assessing Senate Bill 118 and the 1% dedication to lottery funds. We used the figures coming from Dr. Rachel Volberg and her specific recommendations to set a budget aimed at the population that she has identified. Then just last December, we published a report called Adolescent Gambling in Oregon was conducted by Matthew Carlson and Thomas Moore. And Dr. Moore has appeared before he's our evaluator and takes a look at how successful our programs are. This was an independent study. It estimated the prevalence of problem in gambling amongst Oregon youth age 13 to 17. And it, again, like the adult study, provides baseline data for which future studies can then compare for any rates of change in the prevalence of gambling. So in fact, that point needs to be borne in mind that since the studies had not been done before in Oregon, these are the baselines from which we measure how we've done. The researchers in this case recommended that future studies included a larger sample and that we have to oversample for minorities because we did not achieve enough to measure impacts amongst our minority population of youth. And ideally, we'd want to follow youth over a longer period of time. The results again from that study, as you may recall, we found 4.1% of Oregon teenagers to be problem gamblers, a higher rate than for adults, which of course raises some concerns that we need to look at in the future, because the data also appeared to show that the younger the child what had begun gambling, the more likely they were to have a problem with pathological gambling. It's something of some serious concern. The behavior thing, that the spread of problem gambling in younger people is growing. We don't know that yet, because it raised a signal. Then we also have a commitment now from the Oregon Lottery for partial funding. We have to raise the rest from private sources, and we are engaged in doing that, to conduct a study of gambling and problem gambling among senior citizens. Later this year, we'll finalize our funding and proceed with the study. There is a concern that homebound or institutionalized senior populations may be more likely to be attracted to organized gaming because of their isolation and their need for attention and for outside activities. So we want to study this population particularly to see if there's a significant problem there. All of our foundation studies have received extensive publicity in television, radio, newspapers, and we've made many efforts to keep the legislature and other policymakers fully informed about it. We believe that this record of achieving baseline data is really the first step in to move to the social impact. We have had discussions, well, actually I started discussing this last June with Dr. Wahlberg and talked with her, as you know, just a couple weeks ago, about her doing an Oregon study on the economic and social costs of gambling. She was also proposed to work with Lewin and Associates. That's a national consulting firm that you might be aware of. They do pretty high quality work, and they were also doing some studies for the National Council. She told us that she definitely wants to return to Oregon and work with us again. She didn't say she wanted to live here forever and study it, but she maintained a strong interest in Oregon. We're very impressed with our fine state and would enjoy coming out again. It was her advice to me, and I'm relaying that to you, to wait until the National Commission completes its work, until we see the scientific comment on that. And when there's a broader acceptance of methodologies that are used and some agreement on what elements we need to look at to go into economic impacts. Plus, we want the opportunity to do our senior study. So we anticipate they'll finish the National Commission. We'll finish in a year our senior study and then be able to move into the social impact study with Dr. Wahlberg. Once again, I just want to point out our willingness to continue to share any gambling research that either we have or we now have a pretty good database of information around the world, and with the World Wide Web, we can provide you with specific references. You can look at documents and download them yourselves if there's any interest in any aspect. And I would turn to Alan Lowe for any comments, if that's your pleasure, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any questions before we move into the Alan Lowe? If not, yes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I direct public policy for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. And as already been said, I was one of those suspects that served on the governor's task force on gaming. And in doing that work, it became very clear that this, unlike some other things, where we really do have some outcome data, we really do have some good information, we don't. And so I was one of those who really did want to have some objective studies in place so that you can make better decisions and so that voters can make better decisions on state, particularly state-sponsored gambling. I was not alone in searching for that information. It came from, in quote, the suspects who, on the other side of the aisle, the ones who were perhaps advocates of adding line games, for example. And so you'll find on the foundation board that there is a balance. I'm there. So is Mike McCallum from the Oregon Restaurant Association. And so it's really in the best interest of all of us on that board that we do objective studies, so that the information then can become available to all of us who need to make decisions in the future about gambling. But we really, as a foundation, do not involve ourselves in those, in quote, political activities. Our purpose, again, is to provide really solid information and build on it. So it isn't just maybe changing direction, but it's making sure that certain parts of our population that we're there to respond. And I think there is a commitment from all of us on the foundation to do good work and to do the kind of work with Dr. Volberg, and all of us, I think, who follow this issue have a great deal of respect for her and her methodologies, and so to make certain again that future decisions are based on good information.
Mr. Chair,
I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay. Ellen, I have a question about you're saying it's a well-balanced kind of a committee.
Mm-hmm.
Is it so well-balanced that you eventually have to get here to satisfy both? What if it's, I know the AML position on the whole concept of the lottery. What if it were to show that, hey, there's no problem over here? Or, likewise, the Restaurant Association found out, hey, this is a tragic, tragic problem. What's your guess at this particular point? Do you try to come to a meeting of minds, or do you have to say, hey, I have, this is the research, I will have to accept it and change my course of action? I'd just like to ask those fun questions once in a while.
Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, the information is something where we work in developing with Mike the request for proposals, the kind of information that's needed. We accept the methodology of the researcher. And so the kind of decisions you're talking about are ones that we would make after the research. And so some of you have heard me said before that I come from the philosophy that we should always reserve the right to be wiser tomorrow. And so maybe the information might be something that might change the direction of either Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon or the Oregon Restaurant Association.
Mr. Chairman, may I also add, Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, that of the nine members of the board, four of them are gambling addiction treatment providers. So they are, first of all, scientists in the sense that they're educated and use research methodology. But in working with the victims of problem pathological gambling, do have a bias. I think it's fair to say pretty broadly that they feel gambling is not a good idea. So there's that kind of mix on our board. We have had some discussions, not about the scientific content of reports, because the facts are the facts, and that's so well researched and documented, you can't argue with it, but rather it's been in the public relations realm, and what is it that we say about it, and that's where we will have some dialogue. And so we do have, you know, a wide variety of interests there, and what we come out with then probably is a little fuller disclosure than you would have if you hadn't had the gambling addiction professionals in there as well, because you might have just more disagreement if it were just the pros and the cons.
I feel that the urgency in this matter in myself, because people just are drowning now, and then we are saying, oh, we don't have enough research about the water, how deep it is, how cold it is, how dirty it is. You know, we need to research. While they're conducting all those research, people just continually dying and drowning. And I don't know whether we can wait too long. We already have some data that the certain people, including young generation and senior citizens, what percentage they are in gambling and what they lose. How many people committed suicide, how many people bankrupted out of this gambling situation. And we have the basic information. Only we need to decide what parameter that we are going to study issue. But shall we involve their family together? And, you know, since they lost the job because of the gambling situation, should we involve that? Well, we just set certain principles and we need to study it. I don't know why we, you know, it's difficult to think about that issue and continually, it looks like a salmon problem. We spent $3 billion in the last 15 years till we couldn't come up with an answer. And we want to put more money on study and research. And we couldn't come up with any answer. Eventually, salmon, you know, that we only just coming 1%, 99% gone, only 1% coming over here. But, you know, I feel that this urgency, we got to do something about it. And if we continually push the pointing and we don't have enough information, I don't think I can accept that as a response to the person in our state.
May I respond?
Yes, please.
I agree with you. There are people who are suffering terribly, and we want to stop that suffering. I'm very sympathetic to wanting to move faster than we've moved in terms of research. I wish that there was a wider body of national and international literature out there. I believe that the time frame I've given you is my best professional recommendation of what's available. One thing that I think, however, and whatever decision you make, that's important to understand, and something that Oregon can be very proud of, is that we are, to my knowledge, the only state that has made a commitment to have gambling addiction treatment available all over the state and has a system in place to manage it and to monitor its performance and to identify people and to bring them in. And our law allows spouses and children of problem gamblers to also be treated. So we have a very comprehensive, wide open safety net for people. So recognize that's probably not adequate to meet all of your concerns, but I do think Oregonians should be proud of the efforts we've made today.
Mr. Chair?
Anthony Gordon?
I would just like to make several comments. First of all, I appreciate very much the work that is clearly going forward through the Oregon Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation. I also appreciate that the work that is going forward is taking place without tax dollars. Is that correct?
All the foundation work is done without tax dollars. That's correct. There are public dollars in the sense of lottery, which gives us dollars. But tax dollars is an absolutely correct statement.
But the research that we are concerned about this afternoon, and that the chair is feeling some sense of urgency about, is research that, in fact, can take place through the foundation and without tax dollars. That's the point I wanted to get to. And we also have the opportunity to rely on an expert, that is Dr. Roberg, who, as I understand it, is not only looking at these issues from a national perspective, but also an international perspective.
Yes.
And she is an expert on the national and international scene, is that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, she has very recently done studies in New Zealand, Australia, Great Britain. Did I mention Sweden?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty much the Western world is having this gambling problem has been going on forever.
Well, I guess, you know, the where I am, Mr. Chair, and I'm fully respecting why the bill is before us, and also respecting and understanding and agreeing with your sense of urgency. We have in place an entity that is an independent entity that is operating without tax dollars, clearly prepared to do the work that would be, that is outlined in Senate Bill 1132. So given that there is this existing entity, I'm wondering why we don't just move forward, endorse and move forward with that piece of the work, deferring to the expertise that exists there. And move on.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
May I respond also that we do, and Mike has alluded to it, we do have treatment in Oregon that works and that is available, and there is a bill in Ways and Means that needs some attention to make sure that continues. And so I invite your attention to that. What is the number?
Senator 118 came with a Dukas recommendation.
From you?
I'd like to put one more comment before we get off. When we, that the state government, that the legislature expanded the video poker game, did they expand it with a study or they just did it? You see what I put at the point?
There was a vote on the floor of the Senate, which, and I will never forget the debate.
The point I'm making, we just extend continually gambling without social study. Now we are going to do something about the social problem. Now they say we need a study. So this is a, we have a two set of rules we are applying in square.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's my comment. Any other comment? Yes.
No, I was just giving you a thumbs up on the idea.
Okay. With that, we are going to close the public hearing on the Senate 1132. What's the choice of members at this point? And are we ready to go for this one, or what do you know to take you into a time on it?
Mr. Chair, I am comfortable deferring to the foundation, the work of the foundation,
okay,
which appears to be carrying out the work that is described in the Senate bill. So I'm wondering, I'm questioning why we would need to move forward with this legislation.
So since they are doing it, consideration, it is not urgent to see this
legislation.
Yes, Corporal?
I guess I need some clarification. I thought they were just up here speaking in favor of the bill. No. Well, what the hell? I think the lottery commission should, and Spirit Mountain and all those people that agreed to pony up the money should be ponying up the money for this darn thing.
Anyway, my the intention is that I'm going to keep this bill for a while. Let's consider when we go back. Let's consider whether it's worthwhile venture or not. Then, if we think it's good thing or any amendment needs to be done, we'll bring it back and we'll see how it's going to happen. So with that, did I close for this hearing? Okay, and. We'll move on to the next one. Okay. Oh, I forgot to mention, is there any person like to testify? I'd like to open a public hearing on 1133. Is there any person like to testify on this deal? Okay, I want to make sure, okay.
So since I'm hearing none, I'm going to close up public hearing at 11:32. What's the next one?
Either Senate Bill 116 or Senate Bill 861.
Which one never been heard before?
Senate Bill 861.
861?
Yes.
Did we hear 8119, 116 before?
Yes.
Okay, sure. Okay. What is the 861? Is what?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Let's open a public hearing, Senate Bill 861. Okay. Hey, Brian, welcome. And Barbara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and with Chair's permission, Barb Hutchinson from LCC will join me at the same time.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, my name is Brian Bowe, and I'm here this afternoon representing the Oregon Retail Liquor Association, which is the trade association of the men and women who sell distilled spirits on contract to the state of Oregon at what are referred to as state liquor stores. Mr. Chairman, we're opposed to Senate Bill 861, and we appreciate any attempts to look critically and examine the way we retail spirits in the state of Oregon. Obviously, my clients have a great stake in that and are interested. The problem that we see with Senate Bill 861 is that it doesn't fully achieve in its scope and address all the issues that really need to be addressed if Oregon is going to make the transition from a true control environment to a privatized environment of retailing spirits. There are a great number of stakeholders in that process, the distillers, the agents, restaurant association, other parties of interest such as Mad Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and just a large number of stakeholders that really need to be involved in that process. And from time to time, people have taken a look at it and kind of have been overwhelmed by the complexity and controversy that's around it, and there hasn't been a whole lot of progress on the subject. Oregon has a very unique system of retailing spirits. They're not private businesses, but yet they're not state employees. And we think it's necessary that if the subject is to be undertaken, we have to, any attempt to address it, has to address that issue head on. Is the state going to stay in the business of controlling distilled spirits, or is it going to pull back and remove itself? To further kind of take an either fish nor fowl system like we have and extend that by trying to change who owns the inventory and that kind of thing, we don't think really accomplishes what needs to be accomplished if you're going to go to a fully privatized environment. So for those reasons, while we appreciate the effort to take a look at it and deal with it, we are opposed to Senate Bill 861 at this time.
Okay. And any questions? Okay, Flat. Bye-bye. You are here to support the bill, right?
For the record, Barbara Hutchinson from the Liquor Commission. The Commission also opposes this bill. We feel very strongly that there are a number of people involved that need to be involved in any such broad discussion as looking at the system as a whole. The Commission is currently undertaking a business plan that deals with this side of our industry. Some things will come out of that, but I think it may be time for us as a larger group involving the governor and legislators and all of our stakeholders to look at this in a broad manner.
Okay. So you are not necessarily opposing, but it's taking more time to keep involved in it and study those issues.
Mr. Chair, we would like to take the time to do that. At this point, we oppose the bill in its current form.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might add to that, the Retail Liquor Agents Association has been talking about an interim process in conjunction with the Commission. We haven't formalized anything yet, but to take a look. As you well know, Mr. Chair, from the position that you hold on the subcommittee of Ways and Means that look at agents' compensation and the OLCC budget, there are many problems with the way that we compensate liquor agents and the way that we handle that. But as Ms. Hutchinson referred to, the process that we envision is kind of a long-term and very thoughtful and deliberate process that involves the governor's office and all the other stakeholders. It would be important, if not essential, that if you're going to change the way OLCC operates and this part of its operation, to form a consensus, some level of consensus, prior to coming into the legislature and things in the field.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, can I ask one? How many people say that OLCC is involved in controlling inventories and checking around these 223 agencies going around checking inventories? What's the total amount of inventories are you keeping in the warehouse? How many people involved in that operation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, are you thinking about how much inventory we keep in the warehouse in terms of
how many
bottles? Or are you talking about the number of people that are...
Dollar amount and also the people working there.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the dollar figures here. I know that both the dollar amounts as well as the people that are allocated to that function are in the budget books that we put together for the Ways and Means Committee. None of us that are here have
forget about that now, man. Well, I'd like to get that information later if I could. And how many people working in controlling the inventories at this point?
Mr. Chair, there's a director of stores who kind of looks at the 234 outlets that we have. And I believe we have only four district managers or district representatives, and each of them are responsible for somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 90, 70 to 90 stores throughout the state.
Okay. What my idea is about is, instead of OLCC controlling the inventory, that they let them buy their own inventory. Then you don't have to worry about the checking their inventory, how many they have, how many stolen, whatever, and let them pay for it, and I give them more little percentage. It will give them more freedom to do their own business as a private entrepreneur, and also they are to work hard. Since they are just an agency, they are not public employee, they are not private, they are in the middle, just controlled by the OLCC.
Mr. Chair, if I might comment,
sure.
There is possibly an unintended consequence of that kind of an approach. Number one, we worry a lot about customer service, and there's a good chance that if they had to purchase their own inventory, that customers would not have the same kind of choices that they have now. But in addition to that, it would mean somewhere in the neighborhood of, I'm guessing, $100,000 upfront investment on the part of these agents. And my guess would be that not more than a handful would ever be able to purchase the inventory and stay in the business that they're in right now.
Okay. I spoke to the people who actually own the inventory, the agency, and they told me they love to buy the inventory and upgrade it, even though they have to loan from the bank. This is not my story, but what they told me, I'm just mentioning to you.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a highly individualized circumstance. Some agents might do that, but I think beyond that, Mr. Chair, the purchase of the inventory is really just one aspect of the privatization puzzle. And if you allow an agent to purchase its inventory, this bill sort of sets us on the road towards going from privatization, but stops right there. And that's referring back to my earlier comments that if we are to undertake this subject, we really owe it to do it in a more wide scope and look at, if we are going to privatize, how would we do that and maintain the same qualities of the current system that we like. I'm not sure. One of our concerns is that, as you referenced, giving a percentage to the agents when they own their inventory, how that would affect the price level, and it could ultimately lead to a price increase to consumers. And as you know, Mr. Chair, Oregon has the third highest prices of distilled spirits in the United States currently. And so there is concern about every time that we continue to raise the price, people, product shifts. And we've seen that in the past. They don't buy distilled spirits. So one of our concerns is that the product remains competitive with other beverage alcohol. And so that's one of our concerns.
Okay. All ready? Any other comment you'd like to make at this point? Okay, I believe sometime in the future this world, this liquor industry has to be privatized. It's just a matter of time. When? I don't know. It could be 100 years later. But in the coming 21st century, just the state cannot control one way or another. You can control maybe certain price structure, but I think privatizing is the way in the future that the regulating electricity and energy sources and telephone, it's about time to let the baby go. And
Mr. Chair, if I might comment on that, some people say that, but sometimes I think that there are a certain number of Oregon birthrights, and one of them is we don't pump our own gas. The second one is we don't pay sales tax. And a nomination for the third one might be that we buy our liquor in state liquor stores and not in a grocery store with the bread and the milk. But maybe 100 years from now, those prerogatives will change.
Okay. I just want to clear my intention is not privatize the oil at all. You control the price, what price they sell. And that's the only what I'm just build up. Let each individual agency buy the inventory. Let them operate the way more efficiently. We don't need more public employee going around each store, checking out how many inventory they have, how many bottles is broken, how many is stolen. Just more public employee making our government bigger. Let them do the job and then still control it, but let them do their own work. That was my the idea behind of this. Yeah. Okay? With that, thank you very much. Is there any other person like to testify on Senate Bill 861? Okay, if not, yeah. Is this going in here? Okay, we have amendment 861. That's one amendment, and why don't you give us what the amendment does?
There may be copies of the amendment in the back.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 861 has an additional section, and in this section there is created two additional members to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. These two members are to be selected from the food and alcohol beverage retail industry.
Okay.
That is the extent of them. The amendments will become effective on April 1st in the year 2000.
Okay. That's making two more additions.
Two additional members to be appointed by the governor so that it would be a seven-member commission instead of a five-member commission.
Okay.
And it would have three members from the industry as opposed to one member from the industry right now.
Okay. And Barbara, would you like to come over and mention that also?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barb Hutchison with the Liquor Commission. I had not seen these amendments until a few minutes ago and have not had an opportunity to talk with either our administrator, Pamela Erickson, or the merchandising people, or the commission. Commissioner, the chair of our commission, Phil Lang, is here right now. I just might mention that a five-member commission has worked very well for a number of years. That sometimes when you add additional bodies, it becomes less manageable and harder for people to get to meetings and to get a quorum. And the fact that this committee has five members and works quite well, I don't believe that we see a need for a change.
Okay.
Each of the congressional districts are represented, and there is an industry representative as well.
Okay. Since Mr. Filler and Commissioner Chair here, would you like to give us some comments on this two members' addition to your commission? Instead of a five, you might like to have a seven.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm going to ask you a question. I just was looking at this. Is it true that right now you have to be 30 years of age to be a commissioner? Is that in the current law?
That wasn't a problem for me, Mr. Chairman.
I recognize that. Well, so, I asked the question. I guess you don't have to be that old to be a senator. That's a strange...
Yeah.
Strange requirement.
How old do we have to be?
A voting age, well, I think you have to be sure.
To be a state senator, you just have to be 21 years of age, I believe, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
You have to look back into the history, really, to understand some of the requirements that are in the statute regarding the OLCC. And after Prohibition was repealed and the governor of the state of Oregon called a special session of the legislature to enact the legislation, and it was in 1933. At that time, the commission was three members, and it stayed three members for a long, long time, and it seems to me it was perhaps in the either the late 60s or the early 70s that it changed to five. There's a possibility of you having to address the issue of the size of the commission after the 2000 census, because at the present time, the commission is made up with one member from each congressional district, and it's been my experience that the larger you get a committee or a commission, the more difficult, as Barbara Hutchison has mentioned, is to get attendance and to have the commission function. At the present time, we sometimes don't have members attend the full commission meetings because of other obligations. And when you're dealing with a citizen commission as such, you know, it certainly is difficult to find people who are willing to serve. And I think that most of the industry would agree that the commission has functioned pretty well.
Okay. Any questions? If not, I think that the Mr. Slang is here. Right now, according to the statute, one member has to come from the industry.
Right.
Okay, the problem is there's no balance in it. You know, the people of the commissioner, even though they're socially well respected, good member, but the majority of the four members might not understand well the industry. Only one person representing the majority of the industry might not be a good balance. And how do you respond to that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, many of the commissions of the state of Oregon prohibit people from the business or the industry that's being regulated from serving on the commission. A good example is the Public Utilities Commission. There's no one representing any of the utilities on, and that's a full-time job. And you just go through the statutes and find commissions and boards, and very few other than attorneys and doctors and dentists have a majority of the people from their profession serving on the board that regulates them.
Okay, as I hear the public hearing of the ways and means, I see a lot of boards from that industry. And I need to do some research on it, but as I understand it, more industry involved in the board and commissions nowadays. And I don't know how many are not actually represented at all of that industry. And I need to do some study, but as far as I know, there are quite a bit a lot.
Mr. I'm just familiar with education and the Board of Education and the Board of Higher Education. They generally avoid having those conflicts. The Teacher Standards and Practices does call for a representative from the various professions on that one. That's the one that does it. Most of them but I don't think I'm practicing educator could be on the state board of education.
It seems to me that the DME is that the all controls the doctors, and those who don't have any knowledge on this medical issue with me. Those who don't understand the medical practice, they are trying to tell the doctors how they should do, how they act. So for me, that the industry should be involved in the board and the commission.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would just like to suggest that before we pursue the bill further, particularly this amendment, that the committee does require a lot more information, which you have alluded to. You said that you'd like to do some more research. As I'm looking at the amendment, it's kind of out of context for me. I'd like to have some more information on the history of the commission and its current makeup and how those appointments came into being. The issue that Senator Duncan raised about the age of the commissioner is an interesting issue in question. I have no idea what the history is behind that, but I would like to know. Again, we're looking at an issue that's kind of out of context with a bigger picture, and I'd like to understand what that bigger picture is before I'm asked to make a decision or move forward. I appreciate that we're having a conversation. It certainly is one we worthy of having. It's just that we're missing a lot of detail.
Okay. I think it's a good suggestion, and I didn't intend to have a work session at all, and only public hearing at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And with more information, we might be able to have a more informed decision on this matter. So with that, I'd like to close Senate Bill, public hearing on Senate Bill 81. And what else do we have? Do we have anything? Do you think we have it? Time to do that at this point. Okay, are the members willing to do about 15 minutes more until 5? Do we have time? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, we'll open up public hearing and the Senate Bill 115. Let's just give us what the one Senate Bill does and what the amendment is.
Yeah. Members of the committee, there is should be in your information dash two amendments to Senate Bill 115 and dash three amendments to Senate Bill 115. Dash two amendments were requested by the committee. Dash three amendments were requested on behalf of a member who perhaps would like to make the introduction of those and explain them currently. If you will recall, the last time that we had a committee meeting on Senate Bills 115 and 119, the committee had rolled the requirements and the provisions of Senate Bill 119 into Senate Bill 115. That continues to be the case. So Senate Bill 115 now includes those provisions that required the OLCC to establish a uniform standard and procedures for all minor decoy operations for the unlawful sale of alcoholic beverages to minors. Those provisions continue to be in this amendment, and in fact, you may refer only to the amendment because the original provisions of the bill have been replaced by this amendment, so you need not refer to the bill. If you look first at the dash two amendments,
okay.
Section 2, Part 1, Subsection 1, Paragraph 1, is the provision that requires the OLCC to develop the uniform standards and procedures and to encourage law enforcement agencies in the state to use such standards for their minor decoy operations. much of this is the same as we discussed before, but I will go through it just for clarification.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And I should know this, but this is a long time. Are there current uniform standards and procedures?
The answer is no.
I'm getting a... I'm seeing nods, and I'm hearing a no.
I'm coming over.
Maybe I
should
let you do your part first.
Oh, yes. Okay, let her explain what's going on first, and then we'll let
her explain.
And I appreciate it.
Okay.
We'll go first.
All right, paragraph 2 requires to the greatest extent possible that the uniform standards and procedures that the commission establishes shall be the same for those minor decoy operations that are conducted by law enforcement agencies and by the OLCC. And number B, that OLCC shall provide for coordination between the commission and law enforcement agencies as to the conduct of minor decoy operations. And number C, shall provide that the commission refrains from conducting minor decoy operations in those areas where a law enforcement agency is also conducting minor decoy operations. And keep in mind, please, that each of those were predicated by the phrase to the greatest extent possible. So they are not mandatory. Rather, to the extent that the OLCC is able to do so, it should do A, B, and C that were just mentioned. Paragraph 3, or subparagraph 3, at the top of page 2, provides that the failure, or rather that a citation, a complaint, or condition that results from a minor decoy operation that does not conform with the uniform standards is not grounds for challenge by the person who made the violation, with the exception of number 4, which follows in the next paragraph. And in paragraph 4, it states that, except for the sanction schedule that OLCC has, in which case, if a complaint is issued or a citation is issued as a result of a minor decoy operation that does not conform to the uniform standards, then that violation shall not count in the sanction schedule that the OLCC uses to develop sanctions for these programs. Paragraph 5 requires the commission to give notice of uniform standards and procedures that they establish to all the law enforcement agencies of the state that conduct minor decoy operations. And paragraph 6 requires the commission to develop and implement a uniform training program for those persons under 21 years of age who act as minor decoys for the OLCC operations. The minors who participate in OLCC minor decoy operations shall be required to take this training program. The training program shall be available for other minors who participate in other programs. And Section 3, the last portion of the amendment, prohibits the Oregon Liquor Control Commission from requiring a licensee to pay a monetary penalty to OLCC if, in fact, that licensee was already required to pay a penalty because of a citation through a civil court and a conviction through a civil court. So it eliminates double penalties.
Okay. Well, Senator Duncan, what was your question?
Well, my question, Mr. Chair, was about current uniform standards and procedures. Is this currently done? Or is this something we've added via this amendment? No, I'm not. I didn't know.
Okay, Barbara, can you give us some light on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, actually, I'd like to invite one of my colleagues up here who has looked at a lot of these things over the years and it is a much technically much more aware of some of what we actually have in practice. But I would like to answer your question, but I think there'll be a number of other questions to Dan McNeil.
Yeah. Okay. Dan McNeil, and I'm a manager in the OLCC regulatory program.
Okay. Senator Duncan, to answer your question, the commission has put together uniform standards. And they have a
Is this new or is this, Mr. Chair, is it new or is this something that's in place now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, it is in place now. As well, the uniform standards that we have developed have been shared. They have been sent to all law enforcement agencies in the state, Sheriff's Office, Chief's Office, the associations, and so forth.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
Well, may I ask another one then, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Okay. You've heard this one discussed. You've had a chance to go over the Dash 2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, we have had the last about 20 minutes to look at both Dash 2 and Dash 3.
Okay. Well, just assuming you've listened to what was said as I was describing them, does this fit into the format now, or is there some are there major differences in here?
There
are some differences. I think we've seen similar versions of this in SB 119, for instance, and some proposals to incorporate this this language in other provisions. One thing that caused me at least some concern, and again, our commissioners haven't had a chance to review this language and take a formal position on this, was, again, the language under 2C, which says that to the greatest extent possible, the commission shall provide the commission will refrain from conducting minor decoy operations in the same geographic area during any period of time which law enforcement agency in the state is conducting minor decoy operations. Again, as a matter of practice, we do try to refrain from conducting decoy operations if we know that local law enforcement is also doing decoy operations in that area. It's a matter of wise use of resources and the most effective use of our resources. The problem we have is that not in every jurisdiction, every local jurisdiction, are we given notice of when the local police agency might be conducting minor decoy operations. Their decoy operations may also be looking at specific types of businesses, such as they may only be dealing with taverns or bars and not package stores, or only package stores and not other establishments that we might have referred under our minor decoy program based on the criteria that we've established. And so those places that they are not going to be looking at would not be getting a look at any under any minor decoy program, and we're concerned about that. I'm also concerned that the language there calling for that coordination might be considered, depending on how Section 4 is construed, which says that we would not impose sanctions based on multiple violations for a decoy operation that was not conducted pursuant to uniform standards and practices established by the Commission under this section. To preface that, currently we do have our standards that we've adopted. If a police agency conducts decoy operations and don't meet our standards for age appearance or standards for the conduct of the minors involved in those operations, say that if they're the minors that they use would lie about their age or misrepresent their age, we wouldn't take an action based on those kind of complaints currently under our standards. My concern here is that given the encouragement earlier in this that we would not have operations that overlap in a geographic district in the same period of time, as you know, potentially that could be interpreted to cause us to throw out any results from any decoy program because we weren't aware that another decoy operation was being conducted, and I'd be concerned that we would have that kind of result as a potential. Again, we haven't had the time to do an in-depth analysis or have legal counsel look at this to see if that language would lead to that result. The third concern that we have is that Section 3, which talks about the commission not requiring a package store licensee to pay out as a civil penalty by reason of an unlawful sale to a minor if the licensee is convicted of an offense by reason of the sale. I know there is a concern expressed, I think, through this section about issues of potential double jeopardy. We have looked into that. We had our Attorney General look into that in the past, and the administrative sanctions that we apply really are applied against the license and the privilege of the person holding the license. It's not an action taken against an individual. Our concern is that the purpose behind our administrative sanction is to get businesses into compliance with the Liquor Control Act and ensure that our businesses are acting lawfully and conducting legal alcohol sales. And we do have a progressive penalty schedule. So the person that commits, a third sale to a minor is facing a different penalty that may include fines and suspension, as opposed to somebody that commits a first sale within a two-year period. Based on the language here, I'd have a concern that we may not be able to apply an effective sanction that would put somebody on our penalty schedule and raise them on that penalty schedule for subsequent violations that are made by the licensee. And the bigger concern there is those are really the sales that concern us the very most are those illegal sales that might be made by our licensees, the people that we expect to be the most responsible alcohol sellers, and the people that we depend on to convey to their employees what the requirements are of the law for legal sales and checking identification. So we would have those concerns about that section as well.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask another question?
Sure.
This may be a difficult one to answer, but hypothetically, let's put it this way. It could be conceivable that a small county in the state, a sheriff, might overlook certain things going on. These are all friends, so you notify each other and so forth. And you could say, well, yeah, we do a minor decoy deal here, and that would leave you out. And I'm wondering, is that a possibility?
Sure. Sure, that's a possibility. We would hope that wouldn't happen, but that would be a possibility.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, if I could just add one thing. In most small communities, our regional and district offices work very closely with local law enforcement, and generally speaking, at least my discussions with the regional managers indicate that our people, along with the local people, go together. They generally are carrying these things out together. We have actually talked to some law enforcement people on the coast who say it's very difficult for them to carry out a minor decoy program or some program like this because they know so many people and they know the parents of the children that might be involved. So they welcome our involvement, generally speaking, when the community is very, very close like that.
Mr. Travis, that crossed my mind, too, that there could be, I could see where maybe a local sheriff who is so close knows everyone in the county. Mm-hmm. And I've lived in that kind of a situation where you know everyone, and it would be much better to have an outsider do it than do it yourself. I could see that. Okay.
Sometimes it's nice to pass the buck.
Yes, I know that.
Okay.
I've happened in my field also.
So my suggestion, if you have some concerns, is it possible you can work with my staff to make it better?
Mr. Chair, I think the commission, we've got a lot of issues on the table, particularly in looking at the original bill and then the -1 amendments and the number of people that came forth that were quite opposed, you know, all of the law enforcement agencies, the chiefs, the sheriffs, the DAs, the prevention groups, the parents. With any kind of a reduction in OLCC's authority to be sure that the liquor laws are being obeyed, I think you also heard both from the commission and outside groups that we're very willing to help people understand the standards that we have developed. We already train the decoys that we use, but we're not really in a position to train decoys all over the state that may be working for law enforcement agencies. So, you know, at this point in time, our commission is willing to go forward with what used to be Senate Bill 119 as it was originally written, that we could support the idea of standards for a minor decoy operation, but we can't ensure that all local jurisdictions will follow them because we don't have any kind of control over them.
When you have a decoy operation, how long do you spend that?
Yeah.
What kind of procedure, what kind of a format that you have?
Yeah. Yeah, what we do right now is we do typically have one-on-one training. Most of the decoys that the OLCC uses are people that are involved in some kind of law enforcement training or explorer program. They're people that have an interest in law enforcement as a career. Our managers or inspectors that are working with them meet with them and go over the guidelines very carefully for our operations. They tell them the things that not only in our standards but also things that they should avoid doing. They make sure that it's very clear to these people that they can't misrepresent their age and what things they are supposed to do if their ID is questioned or their age is questioned. So we do extensive training with them. It's a one-on-one personalized training. I couldn't tell you, you know, the period of hours, you know, how much time is spent on the training, but I do know that it's a very thorough training.
Do you have any format, any guidelines written in that format and guidelines, the training that you have for the Minor Decoy program?
I have not been personally involved in that training, so I can't answer that question. I believe we do, but I don't have a, I can't from my personal knowledge say that yes, we do.
I thought you just told me you have an extensive training program for
them. I know that the training that we go through with them is very extensive, and going over our decoy policies and the procedures and going through situations with them, whether that's formalized and written down as to, you know, here is the training they go through. In that formal sense, I don't know. It's a, I believe, a one-on-one training that is customized for each person.
And situation. Senator Lynn,
yes.
I believe that James Miller at one point testified. I'm a little confused as to whether or not it was, I know he did it in the summer interim committee. He did it as well at the our budget hearing. And I'm not sure he's been to this committee as it exists right now. And he is the person that kind of has oversight over this. And he explained how he recruits, and that each of these kids that come in on their own, and there may be one person involved tonight, and there may be a totally different person involved another night, depending on their schedules. Most of these kids go to school as well. And we can find out whether or not they have it written, but it's generally the inspector that's going out has a way that they prefer to do their inspections and investigations, and it becomes a fairly personalized approach to this. It's like any law enforcement person has their own way of approaching people. It's a personality sort of thing. But we can see if there's anything written.
Yes, and do you also train the decoy minor operation, the minors that the police officer use also? What do you do, your own training?
We do our own training for the people that work with the OLCC. The police agencies do their own recruitment and training. There may be some training done by our people if it's a joint cooperative effort where our people are either joining the local police agency and riding along, but we, you know, our focus is in training the people that we use.
What you are telling me is that you train your own people one by one, and then a police station each their own, they do their own training. We don't have a set of training from. That's why we need this deal. That's why, you know, I'm writing this deal to make sure there's a uniform standard training. Otherwise, just every agency, every department, every police office, they have their own set of training. We don't know which is the right one. Or are they doing proceed in a right way, you know, legally? Because that's mom and pop operators, they're just sometimes, you know, they don't know what's going into. They're very afraid all the time. It's just creating that police state for them. Because they're very fear of this operation. You know, I don't have to explain all of those things. And the time is running out, but what I like to have that the set of, if you have any set of training guidelines, I like to have that. Okay? And also, if any other police agencies might have it, I like to have that guidelines also. So with that, we might be able to develop some of that program. And I feel that, yeah, your agency just doesn't want to change. You know, just want, you know, keep it as it is, the way you want to be. You know, in this coming age, sometimes when is something better coming up, you are willing to change and accommodate. But instead of all the time coming, just, oh, we don't want it, we don't want to change it, you know, just the status quo is not going to do good for our state. Sometimes it's good, but not all the time. Okay. Any other comments?
Mr. Chairman, just for my own clarification, I believe I heard it stated that the commission can support Senate Bill 119 as originally written. Did I hear that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we don't actually take a favorable position, but the commissioners did not say they were against it. Generally, the commission takes a neutral position on most bills. We're very happy to pursue that line of thinking. We do already have the standards in place, and we're certainly we put together a report anyway, so we can certainly pursue that.
Okay. What I would request is if you or someone from the commission could come and visit with me. I want to get some more clarity around what is already in place with regard to the uniform standards and the training to the standards that is currently in place. I need someone to walk through with me what you already have in place so that I'm more comfortable with what I'm hearing today.
As broadly, we can make that happen.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no other comment, no question, thank you very much. And with that, I'd like to close the public hearing at Senate Bill 115. And I think the time ran out, so we will have some of the time, hopefully, work session on this one. And with that, if there's no business, that's it. Meeting is adjourned.
Pardon?
What is okay.
I'll stay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, come on over. I'd like to open a public hearing in at Bill 115, right?
Yes.
Okay. Did you sign up the paper?
I did.
Oh, I'm sorry. Pardon me. Okay.
I had the, for the record, my name is M. Catherine Lunsford Bowles. And I thought I was, I had the wrong Senate bill numbers down originally.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for waiting so long. I appreciate your patience.
Thank you very much. I have some real concerns about this Section 3 that you have on this now amended part that I've never seen before.
You're talking about the amendment.
Yeah, the one that says that the actual owners of the business shouldn't be held liable and that the clerk should be held liable.
And could you explain which one are you talking about? Are you talking about the original deal? Are you talking about the amendment?
Well, original, I thought I was testifying on the original, but
no, original is gone.
Yes, exactly. I understand you cannot. So I guess that there is this section about,
if you look at the top and tell us what the number is?
Yeah. Is it the -2 one? Mm-hmm. Or it might be the -3.
Look right
I think
here.
It must be the -2.
Look right here.
Yes, I see it, -2. Section 3. Does that not... Is that not about the owner of the store not being responsible and that's
No, it's not.
I see. So now we're not going to hold the clerks more responsible than the owners?
It's fucking the original.
Could you read the section that you're concerned about so we know we're talking about the same thing?
Well, we may not be because I didn't know about these -2 and -3 things when I wrote my testimony. And so I thought that I was testifying on this concern that I had about the social contract of all of us. And so
it had a long
and it's not
that's a little,
part.
No longer part. That's yeah. Well, thanks to schedule we completely dropped that.
You did?
Yes.
Okay. Then I have no concerns about that section.
I will appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me get on the system here.
Don Loving.
Don Loving. Maybe it's
done by now.
Okay. Is there any person like to testify on Senate Bill 115? Okay. Then we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 115. And if there's no other business, then it's needed. Thank you for the patience.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was-